The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of any organization, including One Generation Away.
The freedom of a people to choose its leaders is the root of liberty.
Keep alive this experiment in liberty.
Liberty, in case you've forgotten, is the soul's right to breathe.
Government should be very minimal in protecting liberty.
Peace cannot be purchased at the cost of liberty.
The sturdy ground of liberty.
Liberty once lost is lost forever.
Fight for their liberty and for our security.
Guarantees individual liberty.
This great republic born alone in liberty.
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 Just how much do you want liberty?
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner,
a production of LibertyNation.com.
Cutting through the double talk, taking on the topics, going after what the politicians really mean, and making it all clear for your freedom and your liberty. Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Facts don't matter. Not anymore. Not to the left. Welcome back into Liberty Nation Radio, a production of LibertyNation.com and heard from coast to coast on the Radio America Network. With the fast-crumbling allegation of a hate crime by scum-of-the-earth Trump supporters against the gay black actor Jussie Smollett, we'll dive into the fullness of fake hate crimes orchestrated by Trump-hating leftists since the 2016 election, and you'll be astounded at the sheer volume of them, and just how far rank-and-file leftists have been willing to go to paint Trump supporters as the worst people in the world. Among those who've been particularly demonized by the left and the Trump-hating media are white women. And LibertyNation.com editor-in-chief Lisa K. Donner will join us to discuss how so many women were and still are willing to break with the sisterhood and support this supposedly woman-hating president. Plus, Scott Cosenza jumps on board for Talkin' Liberty, featuring threats and promising developments regarding your individual liberty.
Say what? Say what? Say what? One more time.
We commence the proceedings with our signature segment, Say What, as we roll out some of the most wacky, astonishing, and damnable things uttered by politicians and the chattering class. Socialists in the Democratic Party, arise again. Bernie is back. The 78-year-old Democratic Socialist who gave Hillary Clinton a scare with his grassroots campaign in 2016 says he's in again for 2020 and uses his official announcement video to, what else, promise free stuff and sound the alarm on climate change.
Real change never takes place from the top on down, but always from the bottom on up.
Bernie Sanders' health care for all idea is gaining steam.
Free tuition. Free college tuition. Free tuition champion, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders added, the greatest threat to national security is climate change.
The future of our planet is at stake.
Sounds much like the identical themes Bernie touted in 2016, and he was asked by John Dickerson of CBS, what will be different this time around?
We're going to win. We are going to also launch what I think is unprecedented in modern American history, and that is a grassroots movement, John, to lay the groundwork for transforming the economic and political life of this country.
That same basic socialist message is now being touted by at least a dozen other candidates for president, so Bernie has gone from feeling the burn to another face in the socialist crowd. Meanwhile, in typical swamp fashion, D.C. is all abuzz about the remarkable comments of Andrew McCabe, the disgraced former number two man at the FBI who lied under oath at least four times, but now seeks redemption through the usual means, a book explaining away his indictment-worthy behavior in trying to take down President Trump. He was asked a question by Anderson Cooper on CNN and gave an answer sure to boost his book sales among Trump haters.
Do you still believe the president could be a Russian asset?
I think it's possible. I think that's why we started our investigation. And I'm really anxious to see where Director Mueller concludes that.
So there is the position of the man who took over from the fired James Comey for 8 days in May as FBI director and was fired himself following an investigation by his own FBI, which concluded that McCabe, quote, made an unauthorized disclosure to the news media, i.e. a leak, and lacked candor, including under oath on multiple occasions, i.e. he lied under oath. McCabe has also admitted, incredibly, that there were discussions of trying to take Trump out through the 25th Amendment, which is designed to remove a president for incapacity. Hey, whatever it takes, McCabe has nothing to lose. Oh, and there's also the fact that McCabe's wife ran for the state Senate in Virginia in 2016 as a Democrat, of course. But even though the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Richard Burr, says his committee's 2-year investigation of Trump-Russia collusion revealed no collusion, the Democrats in the House are not about to quit investigating the whole collusion narrative. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Adam Schiff said so on, where else, CNN.
You can see evidence in plain sight on the issue of collusion, pretty compelling evidence. Now, there's a difference between seeing evidence of collusion and being able to prove a criminal conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. When you look, for example, at the emails to set up the meeting in Trump Tower, it was offered to the Trump campaign, to the president's own son, dirt on Hillary Clinton as part of what was described as the Russian government's effort to help Donald Trump in the campaign. And the response from the campaign was, we would love to have the help.
So Schiff is using one meeting at Trump Tower where the promise of dirt on Trump's political opponent was never even delivered, and acting like Trump would be the first guy running for office to ever welcome dirt on his opponent. Folks, that is a way of life in the D.C. swamp. I'm sure Hillary rejected all the dirt presented to her about Donald Trump. Meanwhile, as the swampocracy continues to lecture us on how Trump is tearing down all the vital institutions of our government, the ultimate politician, the guy who spent every day of his adult life as a professional politician and who's making noises about running for president for a third time in 2020, Joe Biden, violated what used to be a sacred tradition in Washington that politics ends at the water's edge. Here is the 78-year-old former vice president speaking this week in Germany.
The America I see values basic human decency, not snatching children from their parents or turning our back on refugees at our border. Americans know that's not right. The American people understand, please, because it makes us embarrassing. The American people know overwhelmingly that that's not right. That's not who we are.
Channeling Obama. That's not who we are. Joe Biden going overseas and attacking his own president and by extension, his own country. But it's not just the Democrats who've done everything in their power to kneecap the president. There remain those bitter, never-Trump Republicans who desperately sought and failed to find a so-called conservative alternative to Trump in 2016. But they're back at it again for 2020 with the guy who ran as the VP on the Libertarian presidential ticket in 2016, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who says he's seriously considering a run because he doesn't like Trump's personality.
Well, I don't think he knows how to act. He thinks he has to humiliate whoever he's dealing with, or else he's half a man. The emergency declaration is just one example of that. Congress thought they had a deal. He says, "Oh, you think you have a deal? I'm going to show you a deal. I'm going to show you who's boss." It's just no way to run a railroad.
Is it your ultimate goal
to weaken President Trump for the general election rather than beating him in a primary?
No, not rather than beating him, but it is part of my thinking to make sure that he doesn't repeat. We don't have six more years of the antics, frankly, that, for want of a better word, that we've seen the last 2 years.
Now, when Republicans consider whether Mr. Weld is a worthy alternative to President Trump, consider this statement from Weld in 2016.
Well, I'm here vouching for Mrs. Clinton, and I think it's high time somebody did. I've known her for 40 years. I worked with her. I know her well professionally. I know her well personally. I know her to be a person of high moral character, a reliable person, and an honest person.
Bill Weld, considering a run against Trump in a GOP primary while vouching for Hillary. In Washington politics, truth really is stranger than fiction. And we'll be back with LibertyNation.com editor-in-chief Lisa K. Donner on those pesky pro-Trump white women.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Exhausted by all the fake news? On LibertyNation.com's YouTube channel, facts and fresh, bold analysis are what you get without the leftist spin. Subscribe today to the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel because
truth
is
making
a
comeback.
We believe that all men are entitled to blessings of liberty.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
A case could be made that the most persecuted people in politics today are conservative women voters. This political demographic has been given a good solid lashing in just about every woman's magazine, not to mention all the leftist websites and establishment newspapers. So writes LibertyNation.com editor-in-chief Lisa K. Donner, my better half, and folks, that really is true. And Lisa joins us now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Tim.
So how do you figure that conservative white women, or more precisely, women who voted for Trump, are an aggrieved minority?
Well, conservative women, and especially conservative white women, have taken quite a beating. Salon magazine, Vogue magazine, you name it. You can't go to the salon and sit down and open a mag rag and not read about how unsisterly we are and how we don't care enough to vote a woman for president. Well, you know, it was interesting. I had a girlfriend visiting me recently, and we're roughly the same age. And I said to her, does it matter to you if a woman is president? She said, absolutely not. What matters to me is the most competent person is president.
Do you think that that's a prevailing view? Apparently not on the left. But what about women writ large? I'm not going to ask you to speak for your entire gender, but do you find more of that point? Is this whole glass ceiling thing still a thing now? Or do younger women kind of think, yeah, one of these days a woman will become president?
Yeah, I think there's kind of a middle group that, and maybe it's a little older than me, I'm not sure, the Gloria Steinem age or something, where they really care about whether a woman is president or not. But, you know, I think for most women, they vote on the issues, at least conservative women. They vote on security. They vote on health care. They vote, they're issue voters. You know, in the last election in 2016, we were called women that basically voted the way our husbands wanted us to vote, which I find absolutely laughable. I mean, I think true feminism means a strong, independent woman. It doesn't necessarily mean a woman in a high position.
Well, you are certainly a strong, independent woman, what I call a true feminist. So I got to ask you, how did you react when that unforgettable footage of Trump bragging about what he's done to women came out a month before the 2016 election?
you know, I don't mean to hurt other women by saying, you know, it was crude, it was lewd, it was rude, but it really didn't matter to me in the scheme of things. I'm not voting on the man's sexuality. And I don't think there's a woman today in my age bracket who hasn't run across a man like that. I mean, you know, that's just neither here nor there when you're running for president, in my humble opinion. Now, I understand a lot of women found it very dismissive, very rude, and it was, of course. But in the scheme of things, I don't think it really changed the views. Well, certainly it didn't, because so many women voted for Trump. It didn't really change the views of women who were voting on the issues.
Do you attribute most of this vitriol against white women to virtue signaling by self-satisfied leftist female elites?
You know, I guess what I see happening on the left is sort of some kind of group demographic. It's like they all want to wear the same thing to signify something. They all want to hashtag Me Too. They all, you know, it's a form of identity politics, I think, in grouping people together. I see conservative women not willing to go along to get along. I see them really have more of a mind of their own. So we're not as grouped, I would guess, as those women on the left who, you know, I don't know, maybe they feel like they have a sisterhood or whatever. But I don't sense that on the right.
You wrote an excellent piece recently on LibertyNation.com. It was after the State of the Union, about how all those left-wing women wearing white together was reflective of the collectivist mindset of the left, and in this case, applying to women. But in that piece, you shone the light on Melania Trump and how the media has ignored this woman. You know, she gets so little coverage that it's often hard to even remember that we have a first lady.
Yeah, I said it was Melania's sixth language, and that is fashion. And you know, she gets hammered by all the mag rags, but I really do think she has an incredible sense of style. And she is an individual, and she dresses for herself. And she, I think, eschews all that collectivism. And I remember, and I'm showing my age a little bit, when we were in the fifth or sixth grade, we all protested one day, and we all came to school wearing pants. Ooh, because we weren't allowed to wear pants. And to me, that's Ooh. What feminism is about. It's being allowed to wear whatever the hell you want to wear. So I think when they say to all these women, okay, you have to wear white because, I think it's a little degrading to women.
For them have to all wear like a uniform in order to prove their feminine bona fides, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a little Stepfordy to me. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I don't want somebody telling me what to wear to signify something or other.
All right, thanks for spending some time with us, Lise.
Well, thank you, Tim, and here's to all the conservative women voters out there. Do whatever floats your boat.
Lisa K. Donner, editor-in-chief of LibertyNation.com. Quick break, and then with Jussie Smollett now all but giving up on his story of being brutally attacked by Trump partisans and now in the crosshairs of the Chicago police, we'll return and chronicle the incredible string of hate crime hoaxes against Trump supporters all the way back to the 2016 election.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Far more important than my political future and far more important than yours, the well-being of our country.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
With the fast unraveling allegations by TV anchor Jussie Smollett that he was attacked by a couple of rabid Trump supporters who punched him out and put a rope around his neck while shouting racist and homophobic slurs, it's about time, it's beyond time, that we place this dubious at best allegation into a broader context. Do facts matter anymore to the rabidly anti-Trump left and a media which dutifully reports on fabricated hate crimes? Let's talk about a pattern of behavior which suggests that leftists have repeatedly fabricated stories out of whole cloth with scurrilous allegations which support their underlying narrative that President Trump is evil. Did you know there have been at least 15 documented hoaxes aimed at Trump supporters since the 2016 election? Here are just three of the fabricated allegations which demonstrate the lengths to which Trump haters are willing to go. A black man in New Jersey was arrested by Philadelphia police for vandalizing multiple vehicles and homes the day after Trump was elected. He'd written messages like "Trump rules" and "black rhymes with witch" on a black woman's car and spray painted Trump's name next to a Nazi swastika on a storefront window. In Volusia County, Florida, a man perpetrated a similar hoax, ultimately admitting to local police that he wrote a message using racial slurs with the KKK and Trump references taped to his ex-girlfriend's car just before throwing a brick through the back window, dousing it in gasoline, and setting it ablaze. A white man in Denton, Texas, claimed to have been the victim of a racist hate crime with someone writing N-word lovers on his garage door. After police opened an arson and hate crime investigation into the incident, Williams admitted he had done the whole thing himself. Now, several of these hoaxes have been perpetrated by Muslim women. In the month after Trump was elected, a Muslim woman in New York City claimed that she was attacked by a group of Trump supporters on a subway train. The police said it never happened, and the woman was charged with filing a fraudulent police report. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, that same month, a Muslim student's claim that she was threatened for wearing her hijab was also discovered to be a hoax. A Muslim student in Lafayette, Louisiana, fabricated a story that her hijab was pulled from her head and robbed by Trump supporters. Now, unsurprisingly, college students have perpetrated more of these hoaxes than any other group. As two students drove through Wellesley College in Massachusetts celebrating Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton, other students claimed these Trump supporters harassed onlookers, spitting and yelling slurs at anti-Trump students. Police found no evidence to support the hate crime allegations. A black female student at Villanova University alleged that after Trump's victory, a group of white men knocked her to the ground as they yelled, "Trump." The woman later dropped the charges and asked campus police and local authorities to shut down their investigations. A student at North Park University in Chicago said 6 days after the election that she had received notes and emails containing homophobic slurs and Trump references. The university president announced that the student had fabricated the entire story. Two students at Williams College in Massachusetts also hoaxed an incident, pouring fake blood on staircases of a building and spelling out KKK on the walls. Now, leftists have tried to minimize these hoaxes by saying Trump is a liar. The left points out, for example, that Trump exaggerated the size of the crowd at his inauguration, or said there were thousands of Muslims who celebrated in New Jersey after 9/11, or overstated the crime problem in El Paso before that city built a wall on the border with Mexico. True enough, he has certainly exaggerated. But it's left to you to compare the magnitude of those misstatements with fabricated stories reported to police of Trump supporters engaged in violent acts targeting blacks and women and Muslims and gay people. Or compare Trump's misstatements to Barack Obama's promise that when he overturned the entire American healthcare system with Obamacare, everyone would be allowed to keep their doctor, keep their healthcare plan, and save an average of $2,500 a year, none of which were true. Now, this diminishing importance of actual facts can also be seen among leftist politicians. The young socialist sensation, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, author of the Green New Deal, which would turn control of the entire economy over to the federal government, has said, among other things, that if we don't take radical action on climate change, the world will end in 12 years. Or that the reason the unemployment rate is so low is that many people are working more than one job. Presidential candidate Cory Booker ridicules those who object to the tens of trillions of dollars it'll cost to implement the Green New Deal, which he compares in importance to fighting Hitler in World War II. Another candidate, Amy Klobuchar, demands radical action on global warming or climate change as she announces her candidacy in a driving snowstorm. As fabricated stories of hate crimes and unsupportable claims by leftist politicians in support of an anti-Trump, anti-conservative narrative become business as usual in an ever more bitterly divided nation, we, my friends, have come dangerously close to the tipping point, the point where actual facts no longer matter. In the end, one question for you about the hoax machine leftists of many stripes have unleashed on this president. If leftists must resort to breaking the law with false and scurrilous accusations in order to undergird their narrative that Trump is the embodiment of evil, how real can the narrative actually be? And we'll be back in just a moment with Talkin' Liberty.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Exhausted by all the fake news? On LibertyNation.com's YouTube channel, facts and fresh, bold analysis are what you get without the leftist spin. Subscribe today to the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel because
truth
is
making
a comeback.
And now it is time for Talkin' Liberty, the segment of Liberty Nation Radio, where we discuss threats and promising developments regarding your individual liberty with constitutional lawyer and LibertyNation.com legal affairs editor Scott Cosenza. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Tim.
Let's talk emergency declaration, since it's most everyone in D.C. is all a Twitter about it. As we say, President Trump declaring an emergency on the southern border, already being sued by everyone and their mother. Weigh in, if you would, on whether you think the ultimate arbiter on this, the Supreme Court, might ultimately grant Trump's wishes or not.
I haven't read all these complaints, Tim, but they all seem to run sort of in a pack together, none of which seems to have a great deal of legal bearing. The Congress supplied conditions under which spending can be diverted. Those conditions are that the president says the words, "This is an emergency," writes it down on a piece of paper. He did so. It seems like it's a full stop there. His offhand comments in the Rose Garden about whether he was required to do it or not seem like pretty thin gruel. And in fact, I thought that this President Trump's analysis of the procession of this case through the courts was on point. And,
really
I expect it to go just that way, Tim.
Yeah, that was remarkable. He did it in that sing-song. He said, "I'm going to file this, and then it's going to be where I'll be sued, and then it will go to a district court, and they'll deliver the wrong decision, and then it'll go to the Ninth Circuit, where it shouldn't go anyway, and they'll say the same thing, and then it'll go to the Supreme Court, and they'll rule the right way," essentially. So what you're saying is that you think the challenges to this are strictly in the political rather than the legal realm.
That seems to be the case. I see a lot of stories around about Pelosi and other Democrats talking about how if they get the executive, that is a future Democrat president, may act unilaterally under some grant of emergency or finding of emergency with respect to perhaps climate change or guns or something like that. And I think it's important that we all keep in mind, when Congress passed these laws, they included exceptions that allow the president under this grant. This is not some thing that Donald Trump has invented for himself, the ability to change the law because of an emergency. That would be, Tim, run amok kind of totalitarianism. That's not what's happened here. And there are no gun laws that I know of, Tim, that say the president can suspend these laws in the event of some emergency. That's about a spending provision, not about our criminal laws.
Well, a couple of facts that are relevant here. This whole declaration is based on a congressional action of 43 years ago in 1976 that established what a national emergency is and what you've been referring to. And I don't think most Americans also realize that we're already under 30 separate states of emergency that are still in force right now. So this is hardly the first time such a declaration has ever been used by a president.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the Supreme Court, Scott, which has made something that will come to be known likely as a landmark ruling on an amendment that Americans are not very familiar with, the Eighth Amendment.
They're about to become much more familiar with it, Tim, because the Supreme Court this week incorporated the Eighth Amendment excessive fine provision against the states. So let's unpack that for a second. The Bill of Rights, all the amendments that incorporate the Bill of Rights, were written as protections for the people or the states against the federal government. Since the Reconstruction Amendment, since the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court has ruled that a number of those amendments can be incorporated against the states, which is to say that those protections that we have against government conduct infringing on our rights can be held against the state governments as well as the federal government. It's the reason why, for instance, state governments can't force us or restrict our free speech just like federal governments can. And the most recent case, Tim, that included a new incorporation was the famous Heller case, which incorporated in part the Second Amendment, or led to the Second Amendment's incorporation against the states in the McDonald case. So a bit of history. What does the Supreme Court say now? The excessive fine provision and protection of the Eighth Amendment is now incorporated against the state. So, for instance, the state wants to seize your car because there's some small quantity of drugs in it. They maybe no longer be able to do so because of this protection. That's where the rubber meets the road. And you'll forgive the pun literally and figuratively in this case.
Indeed. So when is the last time that the court delivered any kind of significant ruling on the excessive fines provision in the Bill of Rights?
Since they haven't incorporated it, they never have. They've always just declined the opportunity to incorporate it. So that's sort of the you have to get the camel's nose under the tent before the rest of it will come. And this is now the camel's nose. I don't mean that in a negative way. I think it's in a positive way. We see so much violence done to the rights of Americans through the state and local governments' use of fines to punish people. And it's high time that it stop. And this is one vehicle to make it stop. It's not a panacea, but this will surely result in more litigation than you can count, where people push back against massive and excessive fines that state and local governments issue.
The case is Timms versus Indiana, and you will be hearing much about it in the days, weeks, and months ahead. Now, Scott, this next story sounds like it's sort of something of a joke, but in fact, it has some serious ramifications. Black people getting new legal protections for their hairstyles in New York City.
So the New York City Commission on Human Rights released, I think they call it rules this week, but they have the function of law, just like any law in the state of New York, whereby black people are not allowed to be discriminated against in employment situations on the basis of their natural hair, treated or untreated hairstyles, dreadlocks, cornrows, twist braids, Bantu knots, fades, or afros, or, Tim, the right to keep their hair in an uncut or untrimmed state. Now, if you read much of the media surrounding this story, what it will sound like is that people have the right to have these kinds of traditional African, or in some cases, traditional African hairstyles. But that's not what the law says, and that's what makes it so breathtaking, Tim. What it says is that that's only true for black people. So literally, you could have a black person with dreadlocks or cornrows standing next to a white person with cornlocks or dreadrows, cornrows or dreadlocks, and the black person gets to keep their hair however they want, because according to the New York City Commission on Human Rights, that's somehow they're somehow entitled to some sort of racial inheritance of a hairstyle, but the white person is not necessarily allowed to keep their hairstyle. So it's a stunning bit of rulemaking, I think, Tim.
How can a law be passed that applies only to one group of people?
This is the first instance I've ever – I mean, so I'm a lawyer. I graduated law school in 1999. I paid attention to laws before that even, and I have never heard of such a thing. It is shocking. What if you're half black, right? In other words, right. Do you still get to have the legal right? Because make no mistake about it. We're not just talking about something that's going to be passed over. Like, this will be in court. Like, there will be people suing tomorrow about the fact that they got dismissed because of their hairstyle or refusal to cut their hair to fit under a uniform hat or something like that. And employers are going to lose, you know, money. And that's why things cost so much more. It's a whole sort of cascading thing. But what constitutes a black person? And here's the funny thing. You know what the Commission on Human Rights says? If you identify as black, Tim, then you get to have your hair however you want. So I suspect on the next census, to the extent that it's asked, we'll see a lot of more identification for black, for people who have
Well, you know, DNA tests for heritage are in right now. I mean, ask Elizabeth Warren with her 0.0014% Indian to prove that she does, in fact, have Native American heritage. And of course, traditionally, the thing is that, you know, those kind of tests were used to discriminate against black people, because if you had 1 ounce of black blood, you were considered black.
Yeah.
Right. The one drop rule. And now it could be used to people's advantage, couldn't it?
Yeah. I don't think even Hitler went to that extreme, Tim. So there you go.
All right. A court has ruled against the New York Police Department union. This is a victory for liberty, saying body cam footage shot by police can be made public.
The Policemen's Benevolent Association, which I think is the largest union in the NYPD, sued the mayor and the police department to block the release of body camera footage. They said it was an exempt under New York State personnel records of police officers, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
You know, there's nothing that's been done in the history of policing, Tim, to make the public have more confidence in police or less confidence where there's bad police. But the fact that we all can rest and know that there's going to be some sort of objective recorder of events that take place when deadly force is involved and the use of force is involved, I think is a huge boon to liberty. And the idea that the PBA would have us, have that footage cloaked in darkness doesn't bode well for their sort of thoughts on who's more likely to exhibit bad behavior, the police or those they encounter in a day's work.
Well, in an environment where police are openly being questioned about their tactics and whether they're racist and so forth, this is hardly a good public relations move to try and hide body cam footage that, you know, by all rights is paid for and should be the property ultimately of the taxpayers, correct?
That's right. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Tim.
This program, Liberty Nation Radio Plus, LibertyNation.com's own podcast, The Uprising, are available to you on demand at LibertyNation.com and from fine podcast providers everywhere. That is it for this week, but we'll be back at you next week. Same time, same station. Till then, this is Tim Donner saying, stand up for liberty. And we'll see you next time on Liberty Nation Radio.